Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Kevin Coogan, author of the vitally important recent book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. And by the way, we're recording this on August 12th of the year 2001. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
Your encyclopedic work on Francis Parker Yockey, Kevin, is one of the best and also one of the longest books written recently about fascism, and it focuses on a fellow named Francis Parker Yockey, a very important man and yet a name unknown to most. For the benefit of people who have not heard our previous interviews, Kevin, can you tell us briefly who he was and what, in your opinion, is his significance?
Well, Francis Parker Yockey was born in the United States in 1917. He was actually born in Chicago. He turned to the radical right actually as early as the 1930s and became very much involved with the German-American Bund. But in the 40s, he worked, he became a lawyer, and after the war, he managed to get himself briefly involved with the war crimes trials process in Germany. Actually, he was based in Wiesbaden, where he fed information to the Germans in the far right who were actually trying to defend Nazi war criminals. He then left Germany and went to Ireland and wrote a book for which he's best known. The book is called Imperium. And Imperium is essentially a very long pseudo-Spenglerian work which argued that fascism had to be rethought in the post-war period. With the defeat of Nazi Germany, the new fascist movement could not simply mimic Hitler, and that a new strategy had to be developed. And this is really his importance. He, through the book Imperium, became one of the first advocates of something we're seeing quite a bit now today, which is the idea of a kind of a transnational fascism, a European-wide fascism, which he called the Imperium. And he set up in the late 1940s a group called the European Liberation Front to promote this ideal. Now, essentially what I do in the book is I show not just the role that he played as an ideologue, but also the role he played as a sort of networker through far-right networks both in Europe, the United States, Central America, and also the Arab world. Now, his end came quite surprisingly. He had been traveling for many years on a whole series of false passports. The reason why he needed these passports is that in the early 50s, the FBI became extremely interested in him. But curiously, not because of so much of his right-wing activity, but because the FBI had gotten reports, I should also say the State Department, had gotten reports that as part of his radicalism, Yockey was arguing inside the European far right that the right should look to an alliance with Russia against the United States, and that the right should collaborate with the Russians in an attempt to essentially weaken United States influence inside Western Europe. And Yockey's argument, unlike many other people in the far right, was that Russia was not a country controlled by either a communist or Jews, etc., but basically by Russian nationalists, and that these Russian nationalists should work with German nationalists and others to force the United States out of Europe and also to challenge the United States inside the Third World or the developing nations. Now, what happened is that during the course of his travels, Yockey was continually interlinking and networking with different far-right groups, and in part, that's one reason why my book became so long, because he just met and dealt with so many fascinating people. But he got caught because he actually, he was flying from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, and his luggage got mixed up in the airport and was sent to Dallas. And really by accident, the luggage was opened to try and trace the owner, and the FBI was notified that the airline attendants had discovered all these false passports. And so the FBI arranged a sting for Yockey and arrested him when he tried to pick up his bags in San Francisco. This was in early June of 1960. Now, the mystery really grew because about a week later, Yockey was found dead in his cell. And it turned out that Yockey, you know, rather than being investigated by the FBI, decided to kill himself. And so the whole mystery of Yockey began really there. And the book that I wrote is essentially an attempt to sort of retrace Yockey's life and to try and get at the hidden part of his life that his own suicide had prevented anyone from learning about.
One thing that I think should be remarked on, at least in passing, is the actual method of his death, because it wasn't as though, you know, he hung himself in his cell. His particular suicide was by a very particular instrumentality.
Yes, he actually had a capsule of cyanide that he took, very much the way, you know, Himmler killed himself, and some other Nazi leaders killed themselves by taking cyanide.
It reminds me of Goering's suicide in exactly the same manner just before his execution at Nuremberg.
Yes, precisely. Yeah, very much so. And one of the mysteries of the book that I try to see is, did Yaki have the cyanide capsule with him? Was the cyanide capsule smuggled in? These are still things that are pretty much open to argument. In my book, I come to the conclusion, but it's a tentative conclusion, that I believe that Yaki probably had the cyanide capsule with him because he had expressed for a long time his willingness to kill himself rather than be captured. And my guess is that probably when he was arrested, he did not have the capsule on him because his arrest actually came as a surprise. So my hypothesis is that that he probably had the capsule in his possessions, and that sooner or later he had been jailed for over, really just a little bit over a week. Maybe some of the possessions that he had with him, you know, came into his possession in jail, and with that came the hidden cyanide capsule.
I would note that the last person to see him a lot, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, wasn't the last person who actually saw him a lot Carto?
No, he wasn't the last person. But what happened is that when Yaki came to San Francisco, it so happened that this San Francisco was the home base of Willis Carto, who we know as head of the Liberty Lobby. But at the time, in early 1960, Carto was a fairly obscure rightist who had been publishing his own little zine, actually called Right Magazine. But Carto had been exposed to Yaki's book Imperium in 1955, when he came across a copy of it while traveling through the United States. And he had become very fascinated by Yaki and greatly admired Yaki based on reading Imperium, which I should add was written under Yaki's pseudonym, which was Ulrich Verange. What happened is that after Yaki was arrested, this was very big news in San Francisco. It was all front page kind of tabloid headlines of a mystery man who had been caught. So Carto went to interview Yaki. I think he interviewed Yaki on a Tuesday, and I believe Yaki committed suicide earlier that next week. So he certainly wasn't the last person to see Yaki. But he interviewed Yaki, and he actually went to visit Yaki to say, look, I'm an admirer of yours. I'd like to help you organize a defense and drum up some publicity for you. So the one recorded encounter that we have of Yaki with Carto is in this context. And because Carto's whole intent was to try and organize other far-rightists in support of Yaki to try and get Yaki out of jail, I tend to think that it's very unlikely that Carto was himself the guy who supplied Yaki with the suicide capsule.
One of the things that you point out in your book is that, in a sense, Yaki's own demise came in an interesting context in light of at least the most recent of the works of his that you discuss, a book called World in Flames. Could you tell us a little bit about that book and how, in your opinion, that dovetailed? Maybe I'm superimposing my own views, but how do you see Yaki's own last work? Let me rephrase the question. How do you see Yaki's own demise and his last work, World in Flames, as fitting? Would you characterize those as perhaps a continuity or in a context, one in the context of the other?
Well, World in Flames, Yaki really wrote as a pamphlet, which he wrote in California, in San Francisco, in 1960. And later, after Yaki's death, it was then republished in a professional way by two of his followers in New York, two of his supporters, a guy named Fred Weiss and another fellow named Harold Keith Thompson. And they brought out Yaki's document as World in Flames.
By the way, both of those individuals spied on behalf of Nazi Germany in World War II.
Yes, absolutely. And Thompson actually brags about it. But with World in Flames, what Yaki was trying to do, in order to really understand World in Flames, first off, I have to say that you have to understand Yaki's kind of bizarre travels to all kinds of unusual places. After he wrote the document that became World in Flames later on, he left San Francisco, traveled to New Orleans, spent about a month, I think about a month and a half in New Orleans with no apparent source of money. Then he went off to Miami and then sort of disappeared. And when the FBI was trying to find out where he had gone, when they were retracing his travels, they discovered that he had spent part of that time after he disappeared from Miami actually in Cuba. And then it turned out that Yaki had been to Cuba about three or four times. So this was extremely fascinating to the FBI, precisely because the Cuba that Yaki was visiting was Fidel Castro's Cuba. And in World in Flames, Yaki's interest both in Cuba and in general, for lack of a better term, the Third World, is very much present, because what Yaki essentially says in that document is that the United States and the Soviet Union are locked into this conflict in which, according to Yaki, the Russians really had superiority. In other words, he believed that the Russians were militarily and strategically better prepared to wage a war, an atomic war, against the United States than the United States was against the Russians. Now, that sounds somewhat contradictory because, of course, the United States had, you know, far more atomic weapons than the Russians. But Yaki's idea was that the United States simply lacked the will as a weak democratic society. The United States lacked the will and the determination to really go to nuclear war, where the Russians were much more willing to engage in confrontation politics and were willing to actually sacrifice the risk of war to achieve geopolitical ends. So this is the first pretext of Yaki's argument. But then he says the real fact is that the Russians, because they themselves see the United States as weak, they realize the United States will actually shy away from confrontation in primarily areas in the Third World. So he said while the United States and Russia are in one sense on a collision course, the real flow of history is really towards Russia as the new power center. And you have to see this in part in the context of the late 1950s. Remember, this is when, you know, Sputnik had gone up, which absolutely shocked the United States. The Russians had emerged with their own, you know, missile program. It was now becoming possible for the Russians to hit United States cities. And this really all blew up really 2 years after Yaki's death with the Bay of Pigs crisis, where the Russians were basically putting missiles in Cuba to hit United States cities. But the point here is that Yaki had seen Russia as the emerging strong power and the United States as a weaker power, and what he wanted to do is he wanted to encourage agitation inside the Third World against the United States, and was willing to work with people, for example, like Castro, who he very much supported, and also Juan Perón in Argentina, as, you know, quote, national leaders against the United States domination. So World in Flames, when you read it, that's really what Yaki is reflecting. He's calling upon forces inside the far right to kind of abandon their anti-communism and support anti-American movements all throughout the Third World.
And what you mentioned that Yaki himself had a very Byzantine life in which he dealt with a lot of different people, and many of those people's true identities remain something obscure. One of the remain at least ambiguous even to this day. One of the many interesting and strange people you talk about is someone who used the name Alexander Scharf, although that it remains to be seen whether that was actually his real name. Could you tell us a little bit about Alexander Scharf and who he was and how he came to intersect with Yaki?
Well, this is a difficult question to answer, and because Scharf is such a mysterious personality. But as you mentioned, so many of the people who were around Yaki were utterly mysterious. But the way Scharf surfaces is that when Yaki came to San Francisco, he was staying at the house, really the apartment of Alexander Scharf, who, by the way, actually lived in Oakland. And when Yaki was arrested, he was arrested at Scharf's apartment. Now, Scharf, it turned out, was teaching at a yeshiva school in Oakland. And in fact, Scharf told the FBI after Yaki had been arrested that he had been a person who had been put in a concentration camp during World War II, had been put in Auschwitz, had managed to survive and relocated to the United States, and was not just Jewish but very religiously so, and a teacher at this school. So then the question was, well, why should a neo-Nazi be palling around with a Holocaust survivor? And as soon as the FBI began to investigate more, both, I should say, the FBI and then also the local authorities, when they realized exactly who they had caught, when the FBI told them who Yaki was, they wanted to contact Scharf. And when they went to re-interview Scharf, it turned out that Scharf had disappeared. And Scharf had basically, what Scharf had done is that Scharf fled the United States. And he fled, of all places, to Cuba, which was the same place that Yaki had been just a few months earlier. Now, to make this story sort of comprehensible, what then happened is that Scharf, about 3 months later, after he'd been located in Cuba by the government, he agreed to come back to California because his argument was that he'd done nothing wrong. He said that he did not know Yaki's true identity, that he had simply met Yaki casually under a different name, and that he was completely innocent, and he had done, you know, and when he fled, he didn't realize that, you know, the government was out to interview him, et cetera, et cetera. So he obviously made some kind of deal where he voluntarily returned to San Francisco from Cuba. Then the case took on another twist, because it then turned out that Alexander Scharf, himself, that was not his real name. He told the court, after he'd returned from Cuba to California, that his real name was Junger, I believe Benjamin Junger. And he told a story about how he had, after the war, after he got out of the concentration camp, he developed a series of sort of false names in order to get out of Europe and go to the New World, if you want to put it that way. The real mystery here is that the first place he went to when he left Europe was he went to Paraguay, which seems like a very bizarre place to go if you've just gotten out of a concentration camp.
By the way, I would add parenthetically, perhaps for newer, younger listeners, Paraguay was one of many Latin American countries that was sort of a repository for Nazi and fascist emigre elements after the war.
Right. And he even at one point claimed that he was a citizen of Paraguay. So when I was trying to follow this case, I mean, what I really try to do in my book is give as many examples of the sort of the bizarre twists and turns of the story without trying to draw a conclusion. But at the end, I felt that there was something that was very significant, which to me really put Scharf/Junger's claims into question, and that is Scharf had spent a lot of time in gambling casinos in Las Vegas and Reno. And he had supposedly had a girlfriend who was of German origin, who had come to the United States herself in the 50s and was working in a casino. Now, the girlfriend told a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle that Scharf was a tremendous admirer of Yaki, but even more important, that Scharf knew Yaki's real name. And my feeling is that because Yaki was such a secretive figure who was so obsessed with concealing his true identity under a myriad of different names, that for someone like Yaki to tell Scharf his actual name signified that Yaki was placing a tremendous amount of trust in this man. So I tend to, without drawing a definitive conclusion about this whole affair, I tend to think that Scharf he certainly wasn't who he had first claimed to be, but I tend to think that probably the relationship between Yaki and Scharf was much closer than simply casual friends.
You speculate that, in fact, Scharf might very well have been the opposite of what he represented himself as being. He might actually have been a fascist or at least a Nazi sympathizer, rather than the Jewish concentration camp victim that he professed to be.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the district attorney in the California case, even said that we're getting reports that Scharf was a neo-Nazi, quote-unquote, flim-flamming as a Jew. So this is one possibility. However, there's another possibility as well, is that Scharf did come from Czechoslovakia, and one of the things that seems very clear is that Yaki in the early 50s himself had some relationship with Czech intelligence. And I describe all this in my book, including the fact that Yaki even wrote a defense of what were called the Prague trials, which occurred in 1952, which were essentially anti-Semitic trials launched against members of the Czech Communist Party with the endorsement of Stalin and the Russians. And so there's another possibility that Scharf could have had some connections with the Czech government. And finally, I say, because this is such a complicated case, it is conceivable that Scharf may have been what he always claimed to be to reporters and people who asked him about these questions, that he simply was an innocent, completely naive person who had been manipulated by this shady character, Yaki. And as I say, the one reason why I feel very suspicious of that explanation per se is that we do have testimony that Scharf did know Yaki under his real name. And for that to happen, it could only have happened if Yaki told him. And to me, that signals a level of comfort that Yaki would have that isn't appropriate if Scharf only was a sort of a casual acquaintance of Yaki.
Yaki himself operated under a number of different relatively sophisticated aliases.
Yes, I mean, the fact is, his aliases ironically tripped him up, because it was precisely the fact that when the baggage handlers at the Dallas airport who opened his luggage to find out, you know, where to send it after his luggage had gotten lost, I mean, they found four separate passports.
Kevin, I'd like to switch tracks ever so slightly from the discussion of two consecutive chapters of your book to some events that have taken place in Italy recently that in turn reflect with or resonate directly on some of the material in your book. Silvio Berlusconi, a former member of the P2 Lodge, has been elected Prime Minister of Italy and has as his coalition partners a number of interesting people ranging from Gianfranco Fini of the Alleanza Nazionale to a fellow named Pino Rauti. And Rauti, who was actually part of this political coalition with Berlusconi, is not only a veteran of the Salo Republic, but also the founder of an organization called Ordine Nuovo. And I wonder if you would briefly review what the Salo Republic was, who was Rauti, and what was Ordine Nuovo?
Well, the Salo Republic was the puppet government that had been set up by the Germans with Mussolini as a front man after Mussolini had been returned to Italy by the Germans. As I guess your listeners may or may not know, the Mussolini was deposed by the Fascist Grand Council in 1943 and put in jail. But what happened is that the Nazis, using Otto Skorzeny, did a daring mission. They flew into a mountaintop jail, rescued Mussolini from the jail, and brought him back to Germany to meet with Hitler. After that happened, the Germans reimposed Mussolini as their kind of puppet leader in a place called Salò in the north of Italy, because the war was such that the Allies had taken, basically, they'd occupied Italy up to the point of, say, the Rome, but above Rome was still pretty much under German control. And so until he was executed in 1945, Mussolini ran this pseudo-republic called Salò, under the German auspices. But the important thing for our consideration is that many of the people who were supporters, really hardcore fascist supporters, relocated to the north of Italy to fight with Mussolini. And after the war ended, the Salò supporters and the Salò veterans became the core group that formed the MSI. And the MSI was the post-war neo-fascist party, which existed for many, many years and still exists with Fini as its head, although, as you mentioned, they no longer call themselves the MSI. But within the MSI, there were different factions. There were essentially three factions. One faction was a group from the primarily representative of voters and officials, old fascist party officials from the south of Italy, who after the war wanted the MSI to become very much a parliamentary party and to work sort of within the world of NATO. There was another section of the MSI which represented the north of Italy and the Salò vets, which was headed by a man named Almirante. And Almirante was much more of a hardliner, and in the kind of weird world of Italian fascism has a kind of like a left and a right side, and Almirante represented the quote-unquote left fascist side, which wanted to nationalize industry and things like that. Now, Rauti enters the picture in the late 40s, because Rauti is a guy who is heading up a whole series of kind of neo-fascist street gangs who are fighting the communists for kind of control of areas of Rome and other cities. And he was extremely much a kind of a proto-skinhead militant, if you can put it that way. And Rauti was one of the people that never particularly liked the Southerners and the more conservatives inside the MSI. And when the conservatives gained the strong hand, he split from the MSI. He split, I think, in 1955, and essentially organized the Black Order along the lines that real fascists don't vote in parliament, they don't take part in elections, they fight the communists in the streets. And so what happened over the years, of course, is that Rauti pops up time and time again in what's sometimes called the strategy of tension, where what is meant by this is essentially that a lot of Italy's post-war security apparatus consisted of former fascist police officials who were never really purged after World War II. There were certain war crime trials in Italy, but by the early 50s, virtually everybody was out of jail. And many of the heads of Italy's, it was called OVRA, the Mussolini spy group was called OVRA, O-V-R-A. And many of those people wound up, just like for example, in Germany, many of the people who were in the Gehlen org had worked for the Nazis. Many of the people in Overa wound up inside the post-war police and security networks inside Italy after the war. In groups, one group was called CIFAR, S-I-F-A-R, another group was called the SID. And these groups, because they were very much concerned with preventing communist popular takeover of Italy through elections or a communist socialist coalition, they very much were attracted to people like Raiuti, who would supply the kind of muscle on the streets, both to fight against the communists, but also to engage in certain provocative attacks and neo-terrorist forms of violence to discredit essentially parliamentary democracy in general and to encourage much more of a sort of a police state in Italy with very lenient rules when it came to the police enforcing, you know, crackdowns on the citizens. So the strategy of tension was a way that the security services in Italy used to try and manipulate popular sentiment against the left and to really build up their own power. So essentially, the neo-fascists operated as what we would call kind of agents provocateurs. Now, that doesn't mean that the neo-fascists themselves were simply paid officials of the government, because many of these people were, you know, highly political. They agreed with the goals of the security services and were more than willing to be trained by them, but not simply as dupes, but as people who were getting something that they wanted themselves, which was to increase their own power and stop the communists. And so Raiuti has always been known as an extreme hard liner, in Italian far-right politics. And when the old MSI changed over to Fini's new group, the National Alliance, Raiuti represented the ultra-hardline element in the party that completely opposed this. And those hardliners basically backed Raiuti in setting up a new political party, which is now part of Berlusconi's government.
And, Kevin, we've got about a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes, before I've got to wrap it here.
Sure.
Raiuti also, and his Ordine Nuovo, hailed, they referred from an ideological standpoint to a fellow who also overlaps Francis Parker Yaki and yet another Italian fascist, well known to veteran listeners steeped in the P2 strategy of tension milieu. And those are respectively Julius Evola and Prince Borghese. I wonder, given the fact that it's impossible, I wonder if you'd try and briefly sum up Ordine Nuovo, Evola and Borghese, and how they would overlap for us. We've only got maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes.
Basically, Evola was the fellow who supplied the ideology for the Blackwater and other of these really hardcore fascist far-right groups. The reason why they liked him so much is that he was as anti the conservatives in the MSI as he was anti-communist. And so he filled their heads with kind of visions of, stormtroopers and particularly the group, the Iron Guard. And he promoted the ideology of the Iron Guard. The Iron Guard, parenthetically, was a far-right group in Romania that Evola had many contacts with. And he brought this kind of Iron Guard crusader spirit to these youth. And so I would say with Evola, he was the inspiration, the ideological inspiration for a lot of the kind of hardcore street fighters of the Italian far-right. Borghese was important because Borghese emerged in the late 40s as a symbol of the Italian military and also as a staunch supporter of Mussolini. Borghese had fought with Mussolini and with the SS in northern Italy during World War II, and after he had been released, I think in 49 or 50, for war crimes, Borghese became a sort of a figurehead hero for the Italian far right, just the way, for example, say someone like General Guderian became a symbol for a lot of old Wehrmacht veterans in Germany. But equally important, Borghese himself developed very strong connections with the United States and the United States intelligence. And so when the United States intelligence was trying to set up things like Operation Gladio, they called upon Borghese's street credibility with veterans of the Italian military to help the CIA, to help them work with the CIA as part of the strategy of tension.
And let me remind listeners that these elements are currently holding power in Italy today, though many of the individuals have obviously passed on. We've been speaking with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by Autonomo Media. You can visit their website at autonomedia.org. I would note that the book was edited by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality on sister station WFMU-FM. For Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.